This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is the Reverend Susan Heath, and she is the coordinator of the South Carolina Bishops Public Education Initiative. It's a program that began in 2014 and has had a statewide impact. So with that introduction, Susan, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter. Good to be here.
The program did begin in 2014, and why don't you give us a little bit of background?
All right, I'd be happy to do that. This program is the work of a covenant relationship among the bishops of liturgical churches in South Carolina. These folks are churches who share the same governmental structure, the same polity, and they had been in relationship with each other for over 30 years. And through that relationship, they had sort of two things that they regularly did: an annual prayer service for Christian Unity, which was held, is still held every year in January. And then they had an annual dialogue where they came together, invited someone to come in and address an area of concern that they all shared. After one of those dialogues, they realized that they probably were squandering their potential, squandering the voice that they collectively had, and decided that instead of having a dialogue where the topic or the focus shifted annually, they wanted to devote their attention to one issue for a time certain. And so they pulled back, and they did what bishops often do. They went on retreat and decided that they would spend some time in retreat and in prayer trying to make the best decision about what that issue would be. And after that time, they narrowed it to public education. And from that conversation, they were aware that most of those fellows, and they are all men, who were bishops, were relatively new to South Carolina, and they did not really know all the nuances and challenges of public education in our state. And so they very wisely got in touch with the expert, Dick Riley, and asked if he would sit with them and walk them through some of what he understood as the opportunity that they had of using their role and their voice collectively in the support of public education. So after that conversation with him, they invited him to address the next year's dialogue, which he did, and it was the largest turnout that they had ever had and the most enthusiasms. They knew that they had hit the right chord, that they'd chosen an issue that was speaking to the people. And so after that dialogue, they did a couple of things. They asked all of their congregations to fill out a survey.
All right, let's just stop for 1 minute and mention the denominations that were involved in this.
Okay, the denominations that are involved in this covenant are the Roman Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church, and the United Methodist Church at its beginning. We have now expanded to include the AME Church, the AME Zion, and the CME Church, which that's a whole wonderful story and should have been part of this covenanted relationship from the beginning, but it's one of the growing edges of the initiative.
And you mentioned Dick Riley, and for some of our listeners out there, it's been a while since Dick Riley's been on the scene.
Well, as people will remember, Dick Riley served our state as governor for two terms and was known as the education governor in that time. And then after that, he went on to serve President Clinton as the Secretary of Education for our country for both terms of Clinton's presidency. And so he is in many ways understood and will always be understood in this part of the world to be the expert in education, and is generous in his willingness to serve as a consultant and an encourager to people who've picked up that role, too.
Let's get back to the story, the successful meeting in 2014. And then the bishops made a public statement, a united public statement, which I can say historically is a little bit unusual.
Yes. And actually, the meeting with Dick Riley was in 2013. And after that meeting, that was in the fall of 2013, they came together and wrote a joint pastoral letter. And you're right, Walter, it is an historical event. In liturgical churches, it is a custom that bishops will periodically write a letter to their people, and it's known as a pastoral letter and is usually read publicly. But for bishops from several denominations to agree to write a letter and each of them to put his name to the letter, I believe it's an historic moment, and they did that. And as you might guess, it took them some time to hammer it out, to come to the decision of what it would actually say. So from the fall of 2013 to the spring of 2014, the letter was actually released to the public in April of 2014.
Having been on several interdenominational gatherings, one in 1976 to try to come up with a prayer or a statement for the country's bicentennial, every time we thought we had something done, there was an objection, and we finally ended up doing nothing.
Well, I think it's one of the exciting things about the work of this public education initiative, because the bishops as a body among themselves have come to realize that the work here is so important that it really does transcend some of the theological differences that they have. And they've had a lot of fun in being able to say that publicly and to live into it, that we're all committed to this. And we could, you know, you can think about some of the ways that we might view public education differently, but their commitment to the support of excellent education for all children in the state of South Carolina has allowed them to move beyond some of those limits.
Well, there's a very important statement in that letter that says, in support of the American experiment in democracy, our nation has realized that education is an essential component to equipping the members of society who can in turn help lead the United States of America into a better future. That's as red, white, and blue as you can get.
Yes, it is. And it is essential, as we all know. And they all were very excited about being able to come together and put their names in support of that thought and that sentiment, which is a powerful one.
Well, and the same document, they recognized that here in South Carolina, we have not always done what we could for education. They referred to the corridor of shame with crumbling buildings and inadequate funding. And it wasn't just saying this is the problem. In addressing their flock, and they reused that term because they are the shepherds, the office of bishop, shepherds of their flock, we as pastoral leaders pledge our commitment to support the full flourishing of public education in South Carolina. We ask our congregations, as well as all people of goodwill, to offer what we can to lift up our schools and those students who face hurdles to reach the best they can achieve in their education. So this just isn't the folks at the top making a pronouncement. They're reaching out to combined denominations, probably 850,000 to 900,000 individuals. That's pretty powerful group.
It is a pretty powerful group, and you've hit it appropriately, Walter, to recognize that it's not just a voice from the top. Their call really is for people to be involved and to build and develop relationships with the schools in their backyard, and to make it known that whether or not you have a child in that school, the children in that school are still your children, and that we're all called to take our role in the support of the best education possible for all the children.
Susan, can you give us some examples over the last 5 years that have really highlighted what's been going on?
Certainly. Well, I'll start with when we first began this work, I had a meeting with Herman Yost, who is the Lutheran bishop for South Carolina. And in that conversation at the end of the meeting, he said, I was weeks into the job. He said, Susan, I've got a meeting this week that you probably want to join me for. He was going to meet with the Richland One person whose job was to make connections between the community and the schools for support. And he had started that conversation with her and with a member of the Pentecostal church prior to the launch of this initiative. So I want to underline that this work is not totally new, that schools have been supported by churches for years. What is new is the collaboration and the coming together of these groups that give us more of a gravitas. So I went with Herman to this meeting with the Richland One district office, and we were exploring ways we could launch something that would be more comprehensive. And so part of this conversation was to ask what they needed, more than to say, we're here to help you or drag y'all out of this muddle. We went into that conversation with, we're here to serve you. What do you need? And our person in that conversation was a wonderful woman named Faye Houston, who has since retired from Richland One. But she gave us a template of what we were, you know, you're not surprised to find. They thought about how they might involve people who come asking. They had some steps and some criteria of roles they were looking for. And in that conversation, we determined that we would take on the most challenging of the roles that she outlined, which was the role of tutor, who would commit for 1 hour a week to one or two children for the whole school year to work with them on reading. So we launched that program with her help, of her making known to elementary school principals in Richland One that she had these folks who wanted to be involved. And the first five elementary schools that responded to her email were the people that then I went with and met to set up this tutoring program, which we named Reading Matters. We ran it as a pilot for a semester, and then in the next school year, for the full year, it's been going on now since 2015, and we're in 11 elementary schools in Richland One, where members of all of the denominations that are a part of this initiative tutor, but we also have people who are in other churches. It's not limited to the churches that are represented by the bishops in the initiative, but includes really anyone who wants to be involved and go through the training and the background check and to make the commitment of the time. So that model of working very closely with the district office and setting up with some real parameters what the tutoring program will look like is something that I've been able to take out and share with people in other parts of the state, and it is, people can replicate it, and people do replicate that tutoring model. And so that's one of our things that we have done.
All right. Well, you mentioned two things I think we can expand on. One is, it's just not somebody come up forward and say, hey, I want to be a tutor and I'm going to be going into the schools. There is a training program, which we'd like you to talk about, and everybody who works with children has got to go through some kind of a background check. And you're also talking about a school year. You're talking about a tremendous commitment.
Right. Some of the things that have made this successful are the fact that we do have some very defined parameters for this program. Of course, the training is important, and that happens with the reading specialist from Richland One, who comes and works with the tutors to get them comfortable with being able to go into the schools and do this. One of the things that we remind everyone who wants to tutor is that those folks are not the teachers. These children have teachers. The role of the tutor is to support what's happening in the classroom. And my recruit line to people who are interested in doing it is, if they say, you know, I'd like to, but I don't think I'm not a teacher, I can't do this, I ask this question: were you read to as a child, or have you ever read to a child? And if you can answer yes to one or both of those questions, then you're eligible to be a tutor. It is part of the role is building the relationship, being there every week, and being an encourager to a child. So, and then from the schools provide the material, and you know, it varies. Different teachers have different things that they ask the tutors to do with their children, but the tutors do not come up with that. The teachers give them what they would like for them to work on. And then the commitment and the promise to, you know, to be there. I've had wonderful folks say, I'd really like to do this, but I'm going to be on a cruise for 6 weeks this fall, and I have to say, well, that this isn't your year. Come another time. You'll have a time when you can make this commitment. When we started this program, Herman Yost said that he wanted to be a tutor, and Herman's wife, Cindy, is a school teacher, and she said, Herman, you'll never be able to keep the commitment. You can't do this, because we've made it very clear that this is what will make it work. And Herman said, I am going to do this. And he did. He has continued to do it. He's done it every year and has missed very few times. And he's my best selling point for that, to be able to say to busy, busy folks, you can eke out this hour. Sometimes you might have to go on Wednesday instead of on Tuesday, but you can make it happen if you choose to make it happen. And I will say that the principals in the schools have said to me in evaluation of this program, you know, a lot of people do come in and offer to tutor. I have had one principal who of the largest school we tutor who says, I don't want any tutors except for yours, because yours really come, and they keep that commitment. So I would hold that up as part of what makes it a successful thing.
And so we're talking about elementary school children third grade, fourth grade?
Actually, we start with the younger children. Most of our tutors work with first or second graders. Okay. Some work with preschool children, and a few do work with third and fourth graders. But we primarily are working with the children in the first and second grades. I tutor, and the children that I've had since we've been doing this have all been either first or second graders.
All right. Susan, since the title of the initiative is South Carolina Bishops Public Education Initiative, is there concern? You know, somebody might say, well, are these folks out there proselyting?
Well, you know, that will always be a question that is asked. And I think one of the really important distinctions that we make is that our whole goal is to support education and develop relationships with the schools in our community. And one of the bylines that I use is a quote, really, of Molly Spearman, who, you know, is the superintendent of education for South Carolina and our colleague in this work. And Molly says that when we go into a school, we do not talk about our Lord, but we act like our Lord in the school. And that's one of the ways that I can diffuse people's concern about people from the faith community offering themselves in support of the school. You know, our work is not to talk about our faith. Our work is to support the schools and to encourage the students. And if they pick up something about the way they're treated that is a result of our faith, all the better. But you know, we don't talk about it in the context of working with the children.
Where else in the state is this initiative in operation?
All over the state. All over the state. And I mentioned earlier that one of the things that the bishops did as they were getting started, before they hired me to do this work, they did a survey of all of the churches that they represent, asking their congregations to answer several questions. And the questions were, are you currently involved in your local school? How often, if you are you in what does your program do? How often are you there? How many people are involved? And is there any collaboration with you and another church in your area? That survey landed on my desk when I came to work, and so I pored over it, and I was looking for several things as a way to, you know, then to introduce myself to people around the state. And to my role really is connecting dots and learning about what people are doing, and then being able to tell people what I have found that other people are doing, and hoping that it will be replicated. So when I read that survey, what I was looking for was capacity and numbers, but also the collaboration. The collaboration piece is key to me, because part of what we find, particularly in the rural areas of the state, a church may have two or three people who are greatly interested in doing something, but on their own it cannot be sustained. But if they work with other churches in their area and go together, and that's not just in the rural areas. I mean, certainly it's true in Columbia, too. You could be in a smaller congregation that wouldn't have the capacity to, you know, sustain a long-term effort. People working together can do that. So that survey gave me a place to learn some things about what predates the initiative, working in the state and building on those. And, you know, I think my favorite program that I found early on was in Kingstree, South Carolina, the work of a group of nuns, the Felician Sisters, who started 20 years ago, moved to that rural community with a mission to impact education, and they have built a fabulous collaboration among several denominations in that area that provides an after-school program for children, and it goes on and on. There are many dimensions to what they're able to do, and they serve as a template, as a way to encourage other people to follow what they've done. And people do have learned from them, are picking up and going. I will say that in my first conversation with them, one of the things they told me was that if children behave well and maintain their academic level, they are awarded opportunities to go to camp. And they've sent the children in their area to all sorts of camps, 4-H camp, you know, all around the state, Boy Scout camp. And I was thinking about that. I drove down to Kingstree to visit with them, and I was thinking about that on my drive back, and realizing that we have a wonderful camp in our diocese that could possibly be the site of some education beyond just the regular camp experience. So I called the director of the camp on my way home from the car and said, what would she think about if next summer we offered a camp that had a reading component to it? And she started laughing, and she said to me, Susan, that's been on the back burner for me for years. There is a program out of the Diocese of Lexington called Reading Camp that I've wanted to bring to South Carolina forever. Just haven't had the energy or the time to make that happen. So long story short, that was the summer. We launched that camp and in the summer of 2015, and it continues. We started the camp as a pilot program, and the children were housed in the side of the camp that's typically used by adults. They were not housed on the campsite, although they participated in the camp activities. This summer, the children, we feel like we've got enough of experience under our belt that we're going to be able to move the children who have reading instruction as part of their day into the tents, into the campsite. So they will continue with their morning activities. Will be working through a cycle of reading instruction with certified teachers from the state, different areas of enhancing reading. And in the afternoon, they will be combined with the children who are not in that part of the camp for the regular camp activities. This will allow us to have more children come to this camp, and it also will allow us to expand our relationships and understanding of each other. So we're very excited about that.
You called it Camp Air, Adventures in Reading. Mm-hmm. And it started out with students from Richland 1 and Aiken County. Is it expanded beyond that now?
It actually started out with children only from Aiken County, and we did that in the first year because the camp is in Aiken, and we had some relationships with the principals in the Aiken area because of the camp director's own children. And as you might imagine, part of any launching this kind of effort is building the trust and the credibility among people who have no idea who we are, why they would want to send their children to this camp. So we it's all built relationally. So after 1 year successful with the Aiken children, because we had deep relationships in Richland 1 through our Reading Matters program, we opened it up to children from Richland 1. We that year actually did have some children who lived in Richland 2 and were not part of the Richland 1 schools, and so it does expand that way. One of our teachers has tutored children in Lexington, and so we've had some children from Lexington also be involved in the camp, and it will expand. It will continue to expand and be open to other children. It's not huge. We will have 32 children as a part of this camp this summer, so some of keeping it where the children are from one or two districts is a logistical help. Transportation is an issue. But I would, one of the things I want to say that it's been very encouraging through this initiative is how much the districts appreciate that we are offering this, and so they want to show us their support by giving in-kind support to what we're doing. And for example, the children who come down to Camp Gravett from Richland 1 come on a Richland 1 school bus that the district provides and has chaperones who ride that bus, and that's their in-kind contribution to the work that we're doing. Back to the Reading Matters program, when the tutors and anyone who works in the school has a background check, Richland 1 pays for that background check as a way of saying, we really are delighted and thrilled that you're working with us in the schools, and therefore we will cover the cost of the background checks for all the people who want to tutor as a part of this program. So that kind of collaboration is just one of the offshoots of this work that's encouraging and fun.
Susan, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking to the Reverend Susan Heath, who is the coordinator for the South Carolina Bishops Public Education Initiative. When a congregation decides to get involved, does a congregation, quote, adopt a school, or they just help? What I'm trying to say is this group is going to help at W.A. Perry, or this group is going to help at Lexington Elementary.
That's one way. I mean, some churches do develop a relationship with the school closest to them, and they encourage the members of their church to tutor in that school. Some churches take part in a program like Reading Matters, where it's set up for them and they come in and they maybe tutor in with people across denominational lines and people not in their parish. Works both ways. Some churches do, as you have sort of described, adopt a school, and they not only tutor, they provide other services for the school, like backpack ministries or providing food for children that don't have food over the weekend. I think one of my favorite programs that I learned about when I first started doing this work was of a church who recognized that they were within walking distance of a school, and that one of the things they could provide was, on teacher work days, a place for students whose parents are working and for whom that is a disruptive element of their life, to have a place, a safe place for children to come on those days when it's a half day at school. And, you know, that happens. Those dates are known ahead of time. So a church can look at the calendar, make a relationship with the principal in the school and say, we would like to offer this. And we have encouraged that replication on the very creative model that I learned about just through talking with one of the churches that's within walking distance of my own home, where they literally had people from that church walk to the school and collect the children, walk them back to the church. They provided a snack. They provided homework assistance, recreation for them from that half day, and then the parents could pick them up from the church. And doing that 6 or 7 times a year is a very doable way to support the school. I will say that the principal, this was for a middle school, and the principal of that school told me that it was her greatest nightmare was the safety of her children on those half days, because middle school children feel they're too old for a babysitter and they're too young to be involved in some of the sports that take, you know, they could have them in a practice for a sport, or they could be going to a part-time job or something else. And they were sort of kids that thought they should be able to do whatever they wanted to do in those times. And she was just tremendously grateful to the creativity of a neighborhood church who said, and of course it was a very regimented, you had to sign in, the parents had to sign up for it, they would walk to the school, get the children, take them back to the church and call the school to say, this is who we actually have. So it was vetted and safe and a wonderful contribution to the community.
Well, that may sound bureaucratic, but in this day and time, it's necessary. Mm-hmm. Again, you've got a model that could be duplicated almost anywhere in South Carolina.
That's right. And that's part of my work, Walter, is when churches will call me and say, we'd like to be involved in support of the initiative, what I have the opportunity to do is to go and provide them several examples of things that they might do. And people take that and run, and they create their own thing. And people will, you know, take a seed, let it grow, and create something wonderful. And I love learning, you know, what people are doing that I had nothing to do with starting, but then I can tell their story to other people and connect those dots.
There are, besides that particular initiative, you can make a phone call as you did in Orangeburg when Teach for America brought new teachers. And so you called the Methodist Church down there, who welcomed them, provided a dinner, helped them get into the community. A little thing that can make a big difference down the line.
Right. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that people really do want to do and love to do, to be able to say, okay, we've got this group of teachers who are coming in to serve our community. It was the easiest thing in the world for me to call the Methodist Church there, which was the largest, you know, close by church, part of our initiative, and say, would y'all do this? And, you know, they brought out all their best cakes and their best macaroni and cheese, and they fed these young people. And, you know, I did not monitor it afterwards. But, you know, my hope and my prayer is that some of those people became a part of that church community or used that church in other ways. I will say that, you know, one of the things that another church in part of the initiative has done with Teach for America teachers in their area was provide tutoring space, because they didn't have a place where they could get together after school to work with these children that would be a safe and appropriate place. And so this church opened their door, and they had some meals that were a part of that too. So hospitality is one of the gifts of communities of faith, and that is one of the things that we can offer and are offering.
Well, I was just thinking of the church facilities around South Carolina where Sunday school classrooms are only used on Sundays. And since when schools are out, there aren't many after-school activities, so that it'll have to take place somewhere else.
That's right. And many churches are figuring out ways to make good use of the very fine space that they have. One of the things I'm really excited to be able to say that will happen this summer in Columbia is the reading camp that I've talked about. We run on the model of a residential camp, so the children, you know, go and spend the week at the camp, and for many of them, it's their first time away from home, and it's a great experience. In addition to the reading instruction, they're getting the fun time of camp. But this model of a reading camp that encourages children in skill and enthusiasm for reading can also be done on a Bible school model. And so that instead of, you know, having the overnight component of it, the children come and spend the day as they would if they were going to Bible school. That's a model that I've been pitching to people ever since we started this reading camp. And I have a church that's going to do it this summer in Columbia. And they're going to run a reading camp on the Bible school model, and they've got the funds to do it. They're going to make it happen, and I believe that it will, you know, serve as an encouragement for other people.
Now you say the Bible school model, and that is usually a half day.
Yes, you know, that in many churches, the typical Bible school model is a half day. But in many churches, the Bible school model is a full day because they recognize that the children that they're serving are children of parents for whom a 9 to noon is nice, but it doesn't help them in providing a safe place for their children to be for the full work day. And so there are churches who have always had Bible school that ran on a school day schedule. And so this camp will do that. The children will have reading instruction in the morning, but they will have extracurricular things in the afternoon. And they may take field trips. You know, this is on the drawing board. But one of the beautiful things is that this will provide those children's parents a safe place and a educational place for them to be for the work day that will be free and will give them a way to, you know, take a deep breath. And I mean, anybody that has young children scrambles in the summer to figure out, you know, what their plans are going to be. And working parents scramble in different ways than non-working parents do. So full day helps.
Okay. Well, we talk about the Bible school model, but again, this is not religious instruction.
Right. That's, you know, you talk to the preacher, you get that language. But, you know, and that's shorthand for something that I think a lot of people understand about a summer program where children come to a place. But yeah, it's, I guess the real contrast would be between a residential camp and a non-residential camp. And that's what we're offering this summer, and hope that other people will pick it up. It can easily be done. It can easily be done.
And that's going to be here in Columbia.
It is. And I do want to just underline the fact that the reading instruction that happens with these children is done by certified teachers. And so it's been really fun recruiting the teachers to do this because they love it. I mean, the teachers who have come to Camp Air come back every summer because they want to be there in this, it's different than the classroom environment. They have a little more freedom and flexibility in providing some reading encouragement instruction to children, and they really like doing it. And I will say on the other side of that, that the principals of the children from the schools where we have had this come to me and ask, could we send more? I've noticed such a difference. You know, we are not at all in the position of being able to say that we are raising someone's reading level in the brief week that we have them. And so that's not our goal. But our goal is to increase confidence and enthusiasm, and we can monitor that by what the people who have these children year-round tell us that they have seen, and by the fact that they want to come back.
Well, is Camp Air at Camp Grabit the only program like that in the state, or are there other camps that...
There are others. That's the only one that we have a direct connection to. Okay. There are other reading camps that churches are doing. Yes, there are.
Okay. I think that's important to get out of, is that you coordinate things, but there are projects and activities going on everywhere.
That's right. It's way beyond what I have a hand in. And part of my work is being able to learn about it and encourage it and connect dots to people who are in communities so that they can support each other.
Well, let's just say you're in some small town and you would like to have your church doing something. May not be a part of the denominations here. Is there a website where they can go to get information?
There is a website. We have this initiative does have a website. But what I would really want to say, I mean, and I don't want to shun that that's obviously a great way to communicate and to know things. And we do have some resources on our website to help people get started. But what I would want people to know is if they are interested in being involved in the support of public education, wherever they are, the best thing to do is to go knock on the door of the school. Introduce yourself, get to know the principal, get to know the teachers, and say, we're the church in your neighborhood, and we want to work with you. How can we serve you? What do you need? Those are the questions. You know, many people, if you've had the experience of trying to initiate that relationship, sometimes people get an icy response from people in the school, because many times folks who go to the schools go because they want to fix it. They want to tell the teachers what they're doing wrong. They want to tell the principals how it could be done better. They don't like it that we don't. They don't like the curriculum. They don't like X. They don't like Y. But if we can go into the schools and say, we're here to serve you, and we want to know what you need, those barriers drop and relationships are built. And, you know, I have schools calling me to ask me for things. For example, every school is supposed to have an improvement council that's made up of members of the community, and getting people to serve on those is difficult. And so principals will call me and say, could I recruit some of your tutors to be a part of this? And, you know, we've been able to help people do that, to serve on some other requirements that the school district asks of them for involvement with the community. So those are some of our spillovers.
All right. What is an improvement council?
It really is a council that just wants to have conversation about how to do what they do better. And my best understanding of it is really hand in glove with the work that we do. It's building relationships among the school and the members of the community that live around it. So it sounds like that it would be a very easy thing, but it's, you know, everybody's precious time is hard to give up for things. And so having people who want to come and be a part of learning some of the challenges of schools and helping them work on how best to fill those is a part of what the council does.
Well, one of the things you said earlier about the church that contacted the school and said, we on the half day we can do that because we are your neighborhood church. In studying South Carolina history and the way things have changed in terms of education, school consolidation, that kind of thing, the whole idea of community where the teachers lived in the neighborhood, they went to the local church, they shopped in the grocery stores, mama and daddy knew everybody, a world that people keep thinking, well, that was great. Well, that world doesn't really exist anymore. I can remember doing a teacher workshop, and there were about 40 teachers from around the state, and I said, how many of you live in the district where you work, shop in the district where you work, worship in the district where you work? And this, particularly those from rural communities, they may commute from, say, Columbia to Pelion or from Spartanburg out in, and they don't shop. I mean, it's not the same kind of world of, I don't want to say the Ozzie and Harriet world of the 1950s, but where everybody knew the teachers, and everybody knows I'm 74 years old, but I can tell you folks who grew up in, and regardless of whether they were black or white, if they were up in Winsboro or another small town, if you misbehaved, somebody told the teacher, somebody told your parents. By the time you got home, you were in big trouble. That community raising a child, that world does not exist.
Well, it doesn't exist in the way that we remember, but some of the dimensions of it are some of the things that we're hoping to build through this initiative by making it clear that even though I tutor in a school that is not the school that where my child would have been zoned, it is within a 10-minute drive of my house. I had never been in that school before we started this work, and many of the tutors who are working in this particular program would fit the same profile that I have just mentioned. They have lived in Columbia for a number of years but had never been in the school, and now we're in the school, and now we know those children, and now those teachers know us, and we're building those kinds of relationships where it does, in ways that we cannot quantify, change the dynamic. It makes people more aware. Part of what I want people to understand about this initiative is part of our work is being aware. It's very important for us to recognize that more than a quarter of the children in South Carolina live in poverty. It's very important for us to recognize that 72% of children in the fourth grade in South Carolina are not reading at a proficient level.
No, 72% of fourth graders are not reading at a proficient level.
In the state of South Carolina.
In the state of South Carolina.
And it's good that you stopped me on that, Walter, because for the district where we live, it's in that percentage would be in the 30s. 31 or 32% of Richland 1 children, Richland 2 children, are not reading at grade level by the end of fourth grade. But statewide, we have 72% of our children not reading at grade level and at the end of fourth grade.
Okay, so that's a staggering statistic. So if they're not reading by the fourth grade, when you're really beginning to move into subject areas where reading is required, obviously you're going to be reading history, you could be reading more sophisticated English, even to be able to read your math book, that means you can see where the slide back begins.
That's right. That's right. And that is why we, in this initiative, focused on literacy, because we were aware of that huge marker, that huge challenge, and it's a way that we could help to address this. We address it not only by taking ourselves into the schools to tutor, we address it by being aware of it and talking about it. And I'd like just to say some positive things about, you know, education in South Carolina. We get, you know, bad markers and talked about, and we are on the bottom of a lot of the ways that education is measured. But we have some great things in South Carolina, too, and some things that we ought to let people know more about and have more available to teachers. We have in South Carolina, at Francis Marion University, a program that is designed to train teachers how to teach children of poverty. Some of the challenges of growing up in poverty have impacts on brain development and on the way we teach, that it's just crucial that folks who are going to be teaching, and poverty is in every part of our state. It's not just in the rural parts of our state, maybe a more high concentration there. But this program at Francis Marion University, which has been recognized and the leader of it, goes all over the country teaching about this and the brain development that's related to it. It's something that we should herald and be proud of and know that we're doing some groundbreaking work there. That's one of the things that the Bishops' Initiative has been able to do. The director of that program is Dr. Tammy Pawlowski, and she came and was the keynoter for one of our dialogues after the bishops bit off the work of education as their focus. We have developed a great relationship with her by not only being when we asked her to do the dialogue, when I called her to have that conversation, she speaks all over the place all the time. But she said, "Susan, I've never spoken to a church group. Will I have currency in that group? How will that work?" She is a committed member of her own faith, but just had not had that opportunity. And I just want to highlight that as one of the ways that this initiative is supporting education in the state by giving her a platform, by letting her bring her very wonderful work into the context of the faith community where now more people know about it and can talk about it. And this is one of the things that I would want folks to know is that when you graduate from an education facility in our state, it is not a requirement that you have this training, although this training is proven to make a great difference in the way that teachers work with children in poverty. And so one of the things we've been able to do is to ask our legislators and to ask our deans of education how we can move to make this a requirement for people who are going to teach in our state. Some kind of fun things like that allow us to broker positive things about education is what I love about this work.
And there are schools of education at almost every institution. Even the smaller traditional liberal arts colleges have education majors. So, I've lost count of the number of colleges we actually have in South Carolina now, public and private. Considerable number, but if they're going to teach in this state, I don't care what school district. Maybe there are a couple of districts where poverty is not an issue, but I think it's every district in the state of South
Carolina.
That's
right. It is every district. So to have this credential and this training to be sensitive to the challenges of coming from a background of poverty, and it's just simple differences that make a huge impact on the way a child learns. One of the things that Tammy has said to us is that if she could make it possible for, if you want to do something for a teacher, take her a box of pencils at the beginning of every semester so that no child ever has to come into the room and not have a pencil. She says it's not because they're irresponsible or that they lose things, but it is if a child does not have a pencil and the teacher fusses at that child for not having a pencil, what that does to the child's ability to concentrate for the next 10 minutes is measurable in the way that brain chemistry works. And so a simple thing like that, a simple thing of just being able to know that, hey, it's really no big deal, here's a pencil, use the pencil, can flip a day for a child. And certainly that's not only children of poverty, but it may more often be children of poverty, and it may more often be that a child gets labeled as from a family where they never come to school with what they need, and, we've got to reverse that.
And I can remember in an education class I took as an undergraduate, the professor used to say, well, sometimes kids get the halo effect and sometimes they get the horns. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, in the third grade, Susie did very well. And that teacher tells the fourth grade teacher, and all of a sudden, Susie's on a golden path, whether or not she is going to exert herself. But Johnny is a problem child.
That's right. And the sensitivity to that, and certainly there are many more sophisticated examples than the pencil example, but my point is making people aware that teachers in our state have access to some training that could turn the tide for a lot of folks. And we ought to know about that. We ought to herald it, and we ought to ask for it to be more widely disseminated among people who are training to be teachers in this state.
Susan, I hate to do this, but Alfred's given me the wind-up sign. So any last words you'd like to have for our listeners?
Oh, goodness. I guess what I would say is it's been great to be on the Journal with you, Walter, and to have this opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that we're doing. I feel like it's we kind of scratched the surface, but I would love for folks to know that I'm so available to meet with and talk with anyone from communities of faith beyond the groups that we represent, but certainly the ones that we do, about how we can be more involved and take a more active role in the positive encouragement of public education in the state of South Carolina. So I know Walter will probably tell you how to reach me as a part of this.
On our website, we will post the contact information for your website.
Right. Great. Thank you.
All right. The Reverend Susan Heath, coordinator for the South Carolina Bishops Public Education Initiative, thanks so much for being with us today on the Journal.
Thank you so much for having me, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed and learned something from today's program. The South Carolina Bishops Public Education Initiative that goes back to 2014 began really as a small seed that has truly blossomed to every corner of the state to help individuals and congregations build relationships with communities and their schools. It's all about education. It's about the future of the children of South Carolina, because those children are our state's future. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.